Just to say, I've sort of been deputed by the De Vere Society of Great Britain, who hosted many of you in Cambridge earlier in the year when you did the De Vere Trail. Marvelous stuff. Anyway, I bring greetings from the other side of the pond. The De Vere Society greets you. Okay, this is very compressed. I hope it'll come across. At certain points, it's not entirely consecutive logically because of the compression. Okay, now we have a collision with. Right, currently there is on the. If you want to see the full text of this talk, or a full text of this talk, it's on my website at that address. I'll show it to you at the end. That's probably best. Is it possible for you to do it for me? Because I'm obviously incompetent here. Perhaps I can signal you a pitch point. Okay, so next one, please. In Isaac Asimov's novel, which is part of a great epic sequence of the future, Robots and Empire, the two key robotic figures, Daniil and Giscard, are meditating upon the implications of Elijah Bailey's their kind of messianic progenitor, his speech to Daniil just before he died. And Daniil meditates on it, and he slowly remarks, "Perhaps," said Daniil slowly, "partner Elijah did not himself understand the significance of what he was saying." It's a tautology that historical significance is only to be understood and unfolds historically. It's completely possible for a phenomenon, even one as vast and profound as the Shakespeare phenomenon, to have its significance only incompletely understood by its own creator and in its own time. I'm starting thinking in this talk particularly in response to Professor Shapiro's claim that to understand Shakespeare biographically and individualistically, even if one does so in appropriate measure and not on the model of a one-to-one parity between life and works, is an anachronism. Well, it's not an anachronism, but to understand why, we need to think a little bit about the nature of historicity. The full significance may not have been accessible to any Elizabethan, including the author himself. This misleads the historically positivistic and simple-minded Professor Shapiro. In the development of our awareness of history and of historicity, we now know that the full implicit historicity of historical phenomena can only be grasped when the understanding of historicity itself as a reflexive reality becomes accessible. So Shakespeare's historicity and its contribution to our sense of time and history is in a sense posthumous and retroactive. Historicity I define as the reflexive recognition woven in consequence into our very sense of the phenomena of irreversible process, event and experience, and civilization and ethos. This implies that a phenomenon may manifest historicity to us in spades, in very large measure, whilst itself not incorporating the meta-analysis of historicity as such. That, in a nutshell, was Hegel's insight. In Macbeth's speech, "If it were done, when 'twere done, for well it were done quickly," we have the most powerful realization of dramatic sequence and of an unfolding of Macbeth's inability to access his own better insight, which is enacted implicitly in the poetic, but which he cannot realize, and therefore he remains self-deceiving. There is a very parallel and similar moment, which has a different outcome, 2 centuries later, 3 centuries later, 2¼ centuries later, in Jane Austen's Emma, when Emma is exploding with the realization that she has deceived herself during the entire previous process of the novel up to that point, when she's confronted with Harriet Smith's indication that she, Harriet, believes Mr. Knightley loves her. And then secondly, there's the realization which comes to Emma when she talks to Mr. Knightley and she realizes that Mr. Knightley has loved her all along. And I can't read out that very long, those two very long and rich, extraordinary passages, extraordinarily full of the irreversibility of process in the sense of historicity. But I can read out just a little. One more. Next one, please. So, Jane Austen, cutting a bit, says, "Within half an hour, Mr. Knightley had passed from a thoroughly distressed state of mind to something so like perfect happiness it could bear no other name, and her change was equal." So he tells the story of how he came to come back to her, following his learning the news about Frank Churchill and Jane Fairfax's secret betrothal. He had ridden home through the rain and had walked up directly after dinner to see her, this sweetest and best of all creatures, faultless in spite of all her faults, bore the discovery. He had found her agitated and low. Frank Churchill was a villain. He heard her declare that she had never loved him. Frank Churchill's character was not desperate. She was his own Emma, by hand and word, when they returned into the house. And if he could have thought of Frank Churchill then, he might have said that he was a very good fellow. So, Jane Austen, like Shakespeare, transposes the process that she's just delineated in profound and poignant depth in the introspective passages into the comic register. But it also abbreviates it as well, so I can read it out to you. Okay, next please. The discovery of historicity was pioneered by Giambattista Vico very precociously, long before the German Romantics and Coleridge reached it. It was nearly 100 years before Coleridge discovered Vico and was most generously appreciative of him. A modern analysis of historicity is to be found in the conservative historical philosopher and historian John Lukács' book, Historical Consciousness, from 1968. Now, there's a later book by Lukács called At the End of an Age, in which he gives an account of George Huppert's book, in a footnote, The Idea of Perfect History. Now, George Huppert argues that this particular French group had developed the concept of history in the late 1500s, in the second half of the 16th century. I think, however, that theirs is an Enlightenment concept of history. Their primary concentration is upon factual accuracy and the conditions for accurate and veracious historical research. They do not grasp the concept of irreversibility in the movement of civilization in the way that Vico grasps it and Coleridge grasps it. Nevertheless, it is possible, and we're trying to find out whether this is the case, it is quite possible that Oxford knew, I think in fact it will be very likely that Oxford knew of the work of these men, and his own strong sense of history will have come from partly from that. Certainly those ideas were around in the French culture of that time. So, the fallback position is, if we were to find the 18th century conception of historicity in Shakespeare, then relative to Professor Shapiro, we're home and dry. The fallback position is that it's implicit in Shakespeare because the concept, the meta-concept of historicity has not yet been discovered. And to that extent, Shapiro is extrapolating from an accurate recognition. But the problem is that he confuses the meta-concept with the implicit and enacted concept. Coleridge shows the new consciousness in such remarks as this from Biographia Literaria, which displays a psychological subtlety and awareness of the many-sidedness of process not possible before that time. And this is the comment which you will know, that he saw it as his aim in writing about supernatural characters such as the Ancient Mariner, to transfer from our inward nature a human interest and semblance of truth, sufficient to procure for these shadows of imagination that willing suspension of disbelief which constitutes poetic faith. The recognition of the multiplicity of frames goes with the understanding of process in the sense of historicity. However, we can certainly recognize that the Shakespeare phenomenon includes this at the implicit level within the poetic. So what is the Shakespeare phenomenon? Yeah, another one. And again. The Gothic enormity of the Shakespeare phenomenon is what I wish to call your attention to, and it is massive. It involves the discovery of a new poetic which evokes process and the historicity of consciousness implicitly. Single-handedly, he created a new poetic, the Shakespearean creative use of language with its cross-referentiality and its inactiveness. This use of language communicates psychic and contextual process, dramatic historicity of consciousness, as never before. It's picked up by poets like Donne and Marvell, up until the time of the advent of what T.S. Eliot calls the dissociation of sensibility, which Eliot links with Milton and Dryden and with the emerging Enlightenment, And when that sets in, the completeness of sensibility is not recovered until the Romantics. And I'll be coming back to that. Shakespeare created poetic drama pretty well single-handedly. He maps the entirety of the Tudor development in the history plays. He evaluates the classical inheritance. He uses all dramatic forms and generates the first true tragedy for 2,000 years. The Shakespeare phenomenon encompasses masterpieces in all extant forms of dramatic art and new ones. Frank Kermode pointed out this includes the only major tragic writing for 2,000 years. The successor works to Shakespeare are mainly in the novel, and the only comparable tragic art at all apart from the novel is to be found in Tristan and Isolde and The Ring of the Nibelungen of Richard Wagner. In Mearsian phrase, just as the great Greek tragedians combine the world of mythos in its death throes as it collides with that of logos and emergent rational consciousness as we know it, so Shakespeare embodies and combines the tragic collision of the medieval world with modern self-consciousness, anticipating the Enlightenment and even beyond the Enlightenment. He miraculously manages seamlessly to interface European and Elizabethan court drama with popular drama, and he manages to combine all of this in drama whose capacity to access the extremes of psychological light and shade is beyond nearly anything until virtually the 20th century. If Macbeth expresses the extreme of darkness and the Van Gogh-like vision of a world darkened by the symbolic raven, the monstrous crow, nothing like it is found in literature again until Richard Wagner's raven-haunted Götterdämmerung. Nothing as dark. There is surely nothing as profound as this single achievement in a single lifetime in all world literature. Such a thing does not just accidentally happen. We do not have to endure what the transpersonal psychologist Ken Wilber might have called the oops theory of authorship. No, it just happened like something on the pavement. The Shakespeare phenomenon cannot possibly be an instance of oops. This mind must have left his finger and footprints all over the Elizabethan and the Jacobean world. Then we have the vast range of lived knowledge, which we've often dwelt on. I won't dwell on that. We have what Richard Malin argues was Oxford's foundation. This is the Earl of Oxford and the making of Shakespeare, very well worth reading. It's a synoptic view of the whole evolution. And he argues that Oxford must have been the driving force in 1575 onwards in the introduction of the first theatre. And then we have the extraordinary posthumous history of the Shakespeare phenomenon. If we're looking for comparable processes, there are two, one of which I won't dwell on, and that is Charles Dickens's creation of the serial novel and the audience that responded to the serial novel in the Victorian era in Britain, which was a massive and enormous achievement and on which all of our novelistic consciousness rests now. But Richard Wagner, over 30 years, achieved the construction of a music drama, unique music drama, and he achieved with the assistance of Ludwig II of Bavaria, he had to turn to a king. He too had to turn to a king. He achieved the creation of a theatrical frame in which it could be performed. Now, Wagner was an impossible and highly egotistical man built on the grand scale. You cannot do this kind of thing unless you're an impossible human being. You can't be a quiet businessman concentrating on litigation and land enclosures and the like. So, we have the additional problem that there's also a cover-up. So there's an invisibilization and an inversion. This, of course, confuses us all. And it leads to the gradual infiltration of the concealment of this phenomenon into all of our understandings. And in that sense, I'll appeal to Earl on this one. The Shakespeare phenomenon is, in the Greek sense which Heidegger develops, aletheic. It is truth in the sense of both revealment and concealment. Very profound. And it is through and through aletheic in all of its ways. And in the Stratford phenomenon is itself aletheic. My teacher, the great critic F.R. Leavis, is very wise about Shakespeare and wrote some very important things about Shakespeare, such as the essays on The Measure for Measure, The Winter's Tale, and Othello. And his understanding of the Shakespearean poetic is unmatched. And his understanding of the context is very profound. But yet he lapses, and I'll read you out a passage, he lapses into the Stratfordian trivialization inadvertently in the parenthesis to which I will call your attention. This passage, which is from English Literature in the University in our time, the Clark Lectures of 1968, he is talking about the university. How long have I got? Okay. Okay. Oh, we're doing well. So, he says, a literature grows out of culture. A great poet, though he may have a profound influence on his native language, by his supremely creative use of it, it develops and is kept living in creative use, didn't create it. Shakespeare had an immeasurably great influence upon English, but could not have done so had he not inherited from a rich, supple, and exquisitely vital language. And then we have the sentence with the parenthesis. The indebtedness of Shakespearean English to the universities. Parenthesis. Though Shakespeare was notoriously not a classical or an English don. End of parenthesis. Now that's the Stratford mythos slipping into this otherwise brilliantly analytic and exploratory passage. And he goes on, and it will link up with things we're all very familiar with. He goes on. Shakespeare's influence on it was immense. The influence of the university on Shakespearean English was immense. A subject on which a first-year man reading English could write at least a page or two, and a maturer student of distinguished mind choosing it for a piece of original work could make very much more of than a language specialist. I will say no more on this head. And I've said nothing about the university wits. So he's only just getting started. He knows this context, yet he still slips into the Stratfordian inversion. This inversion is what we indeed find. Whilst there's a whole immense mass of fascinating and amazing subterranean materials, perhaps the three most extraordinary and ambiguous ones are Grotesworth in 1592, which it's just been fairly strongly established on Nina Green's Phaeton, that Grotesworth followed, not preceded, the first of Gabriel Harvey's letters, which it's generally been assumed are a response to Grotesworth. It's therefore very, very murky and mysterious, but I won't go into it. The second one, equally extraordinary as we know, and obviously we have many views in this room on this matter, but I think everyone in this room would agree that the publication of the sonnets in 1609 was one of the most bizarre and extraordinary occurrences in publication history in all time. And then the pièce de résistance, the first folio. Again, I needn't to you guys dwell on this, but surely the first folio, for anyone who has eyes to see, is one of the most iridescently and miraculously ambiguous documents that has ever been produced in publication history. So we have the beginnings of a long-continued process of mystification and bemusement. It's also to be considered that Shakespeare plays a great part in the development of a world consciousness in the English-speaking world, in Britain, in the Americas, and then more widely. At the same time, the British mind, if I may so call it, has always been unequal to its world historical protagonists, above all Shakespeare and Coleridge. The Stratford mythos sorted very well with the emergent Whig settlement in Britain, which was then followed through in more revolutionary form in America, and which has interesting implications for the relationships of the United States and Canada. But it's also been all-pervasive throughout the old Commonwealth, and it probably is beginning to affect consciousness in the newer Commonwealth of India in particular, I would think. So what we find, and it's to some extent a Europe-wide phenomenon, but it's particularly acute in England, where the scientific revolution of 1660 and the foundation of the Royal Society and so on is beginning the Enlightenment. The greatest 18th century critic is Samuel Johnson. And the preface to Shakespeare is a very powerful and impressive work. But fundamentally, Johnson does not get Shakespeare at all. There are many marks of this. I'll read out one which illustrates it, and that is his failure to understand Shakespearean tragedy. Though it is interesting that in his specific comments on particular plays like Othello and King Lear, he sings a somewhat different tune, but he is so devastated by the ghastliness of what happens in those plays that he can't tolerate it. So what he writes in the preface about tragedy is this. In tragedy, he often writes with great appearance of toil and study what is written at last with little felicity, but in his comic scenes he seems to produce without labour what no labour can improve. In tragedy he is always struggling after some occasion to be comic, but in comedy he seems to repose or to luxuriate as in a mode of thinking congenial to his nature. In his tragic scenes there is always something wanting, but his comedy often surprises expectation or desire. His tragedy seems to be skill, his comedy to be instinct. This is not a man who understands the tragic work of Shakespeare. Of course, he's a profound, very profound person, and his awareness of the tragic at peak moments, particularly in his conversation as recorded by Boswell, in, for example, the episode of Bennet Langton's Will, which I might talk about in questions, he actually has a profound tragic sense. And indeed, his whole pessimistic philosophy might be considered to be a tragic sense. But it, because of the 18th century preconceptions, he cannot translate it into an adequate appreciation of Shakespearean tragedy and the Shakespeare poetic. So it is not until we reach Coleridge that we have a mind that can recover for us the kind of extraordinary grasp of the Shakespeare phenomenon which is expressed in Ben Jonson's panegyric in the First Folio. So I don't have time to dwell on this, but I want to say that the Coleridgean recreation of Shakespearean consciousness is still our Shakespeare. We can argue with Coleridge's particular interpretations, but Coleridge gives us a modern Shakespeare, a highly sophisticated Shakespeare. I can read out an extraordinary passage which some of you will know from Biographia Literaria, questions, if you like, about Shakespeare's mind, but I just want to read out two passages now. Firstly, he has an extraordinary understanding of Shakespeare as a court and courtly and courtier poet. And he relates this to what our astrological friend Priscilla might well have called the mercurial character of Shakespeare. Shakespeare's characters might be reduced to a few, that is to say, to a few classes of characters. If you took his gentleman, for instance, the character of Biron was seen again in Mercutio, in Benedick, and in a variety of others. They were men who combined the politeness of the courtier with the faculties of intellect, the powers of combination, which only belong to an intellectual mind. The wonder was how he should thus disguise himself and have such miraculous powers of conveying the poet without even raising in ourselves the consciousness of him. Of course, the Stratford mythos is at work in that sentence. In the address of Mercutio to Romeo regarding the fairy queen Mab, there would be noticed all the fancy of the poet, but the language in which it was contained, such a facility that one would say almost that it was impossible for it to be thought unless it were thought as naturally and without effect as Mercutio represented it. This was the great art by which Shakespeare combined the poet and the gentleman. Throughout borrowing from his own most amiable character that which could only combine them, a perfect simplicity of mind, a delight in what was excellent for its own sake, without reference to himself as causing it. Again, I see the footprints of the Stratford mythos in that sentence. In the Coleridge Marginalia, which I thought I'd obtained a copy of, and then it went missing in the post or was stolen, and I had to be reimbursed by Amazon, and it turned out it was the only bloody copy in the world, so I can't get it, although I do have access to the University of the Welsh National Library, and I think I will eventually get it. But this is what he wrote about. He unerringly homes in on the scene where Lear and the Fool and Kent enter poor Tom's cabin, which I made absolutely central to my analysis of King Lear in my book chapter and in the shortened version of it, which is published in Brief Chronicles 2, I think. What a world's convention of agonies! Surely never was such a scene conceived before or since. Take it but as a picture for the eye only. It's more terrific than any a Michelangelo inspired by a Dante could have conceived, and which none but a Michelangelo could have executed. Or let it have been uttered to the blind. The howlings of convulsed nature would seem consented in the voice of conscious humanity. There's nothing like that in Samuel Johnson. So, to finish, the mighty-minded, hidden, tragic, and burlesquing court clown who created these works is vividly evoked for us by several contemporaries, such as Gabriel Harvey in Speculum Tuscanismi. But perhaps the most powerful testimony is that of his sworn enemy, Charles Arundel, in the interrogatories given in relation to the Howard and Arundel libels. And he makes it quite clear that Oxford had the same conversational capacity, which is what we would expect from the creator of Falstaff, Hamlet, and all the rest. The same conversational capacity that Coleridge himself has, that Samuel Johnson has, that Oscar Wilde has, that Byron had, that Sidney Smith had. So I'll not read the whole passage, but he's given a description. It's on Alan Nelson's website, all of this. He's given a description of how Oxford would launch into hyperbolic descriptions of how he had been employed by the Duke of Alva to pacify relationships and avoid a battle and so on and so forth in a particular situation in Milan, I think. And Arundel comments upon the way in which Oxford talked about this. He says that in his action he showed so great discretion and government as by his wisdom the matters were compounded, and an accord being more for his own glory than if he had fought the battle. This lie is very rife with him, and in it he glories greatly. Diversely hath he told it, and when he enters into it, he can hardly out, which he hath made such sport, as often have I been driven to rise from his table laughing, as hath my Lord Charles Howard and the rest, whom I named before, and for the proof of this, I take them all as witnesses. So he could reduce a table, as he also in Hamlet indicates that Yorick could reduce a table to convulsive laughter so uncontrollable that people had to leave the room. That is what we would expect from the author of these works. Of course, in the burlesque, there's a hidden humility, a profound Christological clowning. And this has such deep roots in the play, and it's transmitted also, particularly through that passage I read out to you by Coleridge in relation to Lear. And we find it again evoked in the creator of the greatest Shakespearean poetic of the 19th century. And in the poem I'm going to read part from, he is, this Gerard Manley Hopkins, he is the title of the poem, which is a very, very great poem indeed, which many of you will know, that nature is a Heraclitean fire and of the comfort of the resurrection. In other words, this belongs with that light and shade mercuriality we know so well from Shakespeare. O pity and indignation, man's shape that shone sheer off, disseveral, a star, death blots black out, nor mark is any of him at all so stark, but vastness blurs and time beats level. Enough, the resurrection, a heart's clarion, away grief's gasping, joyless days, dejection, across my foundering deck shone a beacon, an eternal beam. Flesh fade and mortal trash fall to the residuary worm, world's wildfire leave but ash, in a flash, at a trumpet crash, I am all at once what Christ is, since he was what I am. And this Jack, joke, poor potsherd, patch, matchwood, immortal diamond, is immortal diamond. And the combination there of the utmost exaltation with the kenotic descent, the loss of Godhead descent into the abyss, is what we find in the greatest passages in Shakespeare, and the more you study Hopkins, the more you realize how profoundly pervaded he is by all of this. And if we don't see the harlequin costume of Bottom, for example, in that final sentence, I don't know what we do see. Thank you very much.
We have time for some questions.
Just a quick question. This is just something probably everybody knows. You said that you went quite quickly over certain situations, but the sonnets published in 1609, why would, and then you made, said that was extraordinary and everybody knows about it, but I don't know about it.
How long have we got?
20 seconds.
Its title is Shakespeare's Sonnets, which implies that the author is dead, as does the phrase our ever-living poet. The introduction. The publication fell dead without a trace. There's no further record of it unless what is possibly a forgery by John Payne Collier, a note in Edward Elaine's papers, actually refers to it. There are only 13 copies extant in the world. There are about 500 of the first folio, and let alone the Venus and Adonis and Lucrece. When it was republished in 1640 by John Benson, it was bowdlerized. It then became invisible again until Malone really discovered them in the late 18th century, and then ever since, of course, there have been major Shakespeare's wars going on about the sonnets, both within Stratfordianism and between Stratfordians and other authorship persuasions.
I think we have time for one more question.
There's a copy of Coleridge on Shakespeare on sale on the SOS website in the book lyrics.
Yes, but that's not the marginalia. I've got Coleridge on Shakespeare.
Yeah.
This is the thing which is in the Princeton edition of the Marginalia, Volume 4, Pamphlets to Shakespeare. And it has suddenly been discovered that it's gold dust and I can't get hold of any of it. Can I instead read you out what I think puts paid to the Stratford mythos that is Coleridge?
Very quickly.
I can find my glasses, I'll be able to read this. I'm not going to be able to read it without my glasses, and my glasses have steamed up. But it's the passage where he says that Shakespeare studied deeply, prepared himself over many years. He didn't become accidentally a writer. He didn't miraculously fall from heaven. He forged himself as a writer, and etc., etc., etc. It's a brilliant passage. It is at the end of chapter 15 of Biographia Literaria, which you will find on Project Gutenberg on the internet.
Thank you, thank you.
Rediscovery of Coleridge's notebooks happened here in Toronto with Catherine Coburn. Amazing story that is.
Now for our next speaker, we have Michael Egan, a friend of mine. He is the editor of the Oxfordian, the SOS Peer Review Journal for the Shakespeare Archive Society. He is an internationally known writer, consultant, and educator, earning his BA from University in South Africa and MA and PhD from Cambridge. He has been a professor of English at the University of Massachusetts, a lecturer in English at Lancaster University in the United Kingdom, and a visiting professor at the University of Hawaii at the University. He's the editing author of 10 books and over 80 professional articles. Please welcome